So what I'm setting up for is I want to criticize the calculation that we did on Friday. And there's many ways to criticize it. And what I want to take you towards is the path integral effect of action. And in particular, I want to get set up the effective act, the Wilsonian effective action. Because at the end of the day, the goal is how big is the answer? And how big is, for the vacuum energy, should be considered to be too big, and should we be worried about large contributions? But before even talking about that, there's a whole bunch of weird things about the answer that we need to nail down. So remember, the upshot of the story was we calculated the energy density, calculated the energy, the vacuum energy, the one-loop corrections to it, and in the situations where the spatial volume was infinite, that was diverging, but the vacuum energy density was the thing that was finite. In the case of flat space with a scalar field self-interacting with a potential, then the answer turned out to be this, where these m squareds you could think of as being functions of phi. So m squared of phi was just b prime prime derivative of the potential. The calculation told us this coefficient. It did not tell us the coefficients a, b, and c. They were arbitrary. If we had calculated, I kind of deliberately calculated them, calculated the answer without dealing with the divergent integrals. The reason that we have arbitrary things in our answer is that the integral we really wanted to do, which was, you remember, we started off with an integral along the lines of d4k logarithm of k squared plus m squared minus I epsilon. That was diverging like crazy. And this a, b, and c is a residue of that, because the logic that allowed us to do this was we differentiated three times with respect to m squared, got something finite, calculated that, then we reintegrated again, and then these were the integration constants for the three integrals. But if we had just stuck a cutoff in here, then we could have also calculated, we would have got the same answer, but we would have had predictions for what the A, Bs, and Cs were. And the important thing is that those predictions depend on how you regulate things. So if we regulate these integrals, integral dk, in the end of the day, we did this in Euclidean signature because we Wick rotated, or at least you did it in the assignment. The integral that was the problem was the integral over the modulus of k. If we had cut that off at some cutoff lambda, we would have basically found these things would be lambda dependent in a way which is consistent with their dimensions. So c is a mass of the fourth, so it would have been quartically divergent. B is proportional to mass squared, so it would have been quadratically divergent. A is dimensionless, it would have been logarithmically divergent. This coefficient, you know, mu is also arbitrary, but mu is not independent of A, B, and C, because if I change mu by some factor, then the logarithm of the factor becomes a constant, and that's a change to the m to the fourth term. So a change in mu is not independent of a change in A. And so that really tells you that because of where the mu's go here, that this A naught had to be minus 1 over 64 pi squared. And then what would have happened then is that the mu's would have canceled, then the lambda would have been appearing in the logarithm here. So there's always, for all of these things, there's a finite piece. You know, the basic ambiguity, if you're starting to identify divergent things, is the thing that's left over is the finite thing, and it's always true, but you can add a finite piece to a divergent piece, and it's still divergent. So there's always a fundamental ambiguity in the values of the finite parts. And so that's what we would have gotten if we'd cut things off in the simplest way possible. But if we had done it in dimensional regularization, which we also could have done, then we could have defined it for an integral dnp rather than d4p. We could have chosen n to be 4 minus 2 epsilon. Epsilon's complex. We take epsilon to 0 at the end of the day. In that kind of a calculation, the only thing in the integral that has any dimensions is m squared. So that means that b and c are 0 if we do that calculation. And what we would have found there is that a is not 0. It would have had something, but it would have been singular as epsilon went to 0. So n goes to 4, where n is the number of dimensions. And so we would have had something like that with the finite part. And this a naught is related to that a naught. And so the mu dependence in that language would have come about because all the dimensions of the parameters in our Lagrangian are different if we're not in four dimensions. And so there's a, if you want to keep all the couplings in the Lagrangian, so when we wrote v was V naught, I don't know if I ever wrote that, but 1/2 m squared pi squared plus 1/4. So the dimension of phi, remember the way we determined the dimensions of the coefficients was the Lagrangian itself was d phi squared minus v. It had to have dimensions in n dimensions. This is a length. This is 1 over a length to the nth, because the integral of dnx of this is the action, which is h bar, which is dimensionless. And so we determine the dimensions of phi by asking this thing to have the right dimensions. We've canonically normalized it, so there's no coefficient, there's no number here that we get to assign any dimension to, and that's kind of a choice of how we've rescaled phi, and this kind of why, the reason we do that is it tells us the dimensions for phi. And it's always, in this case, going to be the dimensions of n over 2 minus 1, where 1 is what the derivative is carrying, if we're thinking in powers of energy. So that means that this term, m, is always going to have the same dimensions as the derivative, so it's always going to have the dimensions of mass, which is good, because it's supposed to be a mass. But this term will have dimensions that will depend on n, and if we wanted to keep them dimensionless, it's the usual story that what we would have done is we would have written lambda as really lambda times, you know, mu over mu naught, if you like, to the n minus 4. That's what we want to have. So the dimensions, so in n dimensions, this has got dimensions, phi has dimensions. If I write square brackets for the dimensions and powers of mass, phi would have had dimensions of n over 2 minus 1. So that means that phi to the fourth would be dimensions of 2n minus 4. And this has got to be the dimensions of the Lagrangian minus that. And so the Lagrangian was dimensions n. I think I'm going to get something which was wrong. So the lambda should be equal to n, which is the dimensions of the Lagrangian, minus the dimensions of phi to the fourth, which is 4 minus n. Good. So it goes to 0 when n goes to 4. And so that means I've got this wrong, 4 minus n. And if I write n is equal to 4 minus 2 epsilon, this would have been, let me write that as, so the way we would have seen this log of mu squared running, it's hidden in here, and it's hidden in here because the couplings we would have rolled a arbitrary scale mu into to keep the coupling itself dimensionless in all dimensions. And then when we start Taylor expanding things in powers of epsilon, these poles start to hit the expansions of the, now this is really, as a series in epsilon, it's 1 plus 2 epsilon log mu over mu naught, and so on. And then that linear term hits the pole and starts to give you things which are depending on mu squared. So the answer, this part we're always going to get, but there's a lot of ambiguity in A, B, and C. It depends on exactly how you regularize things. So before we start arguing about the size of the answer, you could say, is the answer big? Is it this big? That's a huge scale because lambda is much bigger than the cutoff, than m. Or is it really that the answer is equal to m to the fourth because really those are zero and that the scale is all being set by m? Before we answer that, we have to answer, you know, what's the how do you deal with the ambiguities here? It's just some random scale just to keep the dimensions. Actually, I didn't want to do that, did I? I want these guys to have dimensions. Never mind. Yeah, I misspoke there. Thank you. So mu to the 4 minus n. Yeah, the point of that was, that's the danger of using the same symbol for two different things. This is the thing that came to us in the Lagrangian. It has dimensions of mass to the 4 minus n, and I wanted this to be dimensionless, so let's call this something else. Let's call this the one that was originally there, and this is the one that we want to be dimensionless, but then we wanted the dimensions to be different and not have it be. So the mu naught was just instinct. I always had to have a mu divided by something. Right, so there's a lot of story here that we have to kind of cut through before arguing about how big the answer is. And something which nobody asked me about, but which you could have asked about, was if we start doing things like, once you start talking about things being different regularization schemes giving you different answers, then there's a lot of things that, other things that could happen besides ambiguities in A, B, and C, right? Because so far we've calculated the energy density. But the reason for calculating it was the physical thing. It's the thing that made sense in the large volume limit. And that's the thing that gravity coupled to. But what gravity coupled not just to the energy density, it couples to the stress energy. What we should have, we should really probably set up a calculation where we're calculating. So what we want is the physical thing. We want to calculate basically the expectation value of T mu. But once we do that, in the symmetries of the space times we're talking about, that'll be a change to the energy density, but also to the pressure. So if we compute T mu, we will get a contribution, a vacuum contribution to the pressure and to the energy density. And one question is it still true that the vacuum energy is equal to minus the energy? Should that be true? If I only calculate the energy density, I can never address that question because I never calculate the pressure. And every 5 years, somebody does this calculation and discovers that, oh, the pressure is wrong. And there's an issue that is related to this issue of the A, Bs, and Cs being ambiguous. And it's the same issues are going to apply here. You know, whether you find that this is true or not, remember, this was the condition, that was basically the condition that the vacuum is Lorentz invariant. Because that was the only, T mu nu proportional to the metric was the only Lorentz invariant choice for the expectation value of T mu nu, if it's going to be a function of the metric. And that was what dictated this equation of state. So the question of whether or not your calculation gives you that will be the question of whether or not your calculation, when you regulate it, breaks Lorentz invariance. Now this, certainly a cutoff, will break Lorentz invariance because someone has to tell you what frame you were making, choosing a maximum energy in. And so typically when people do these calculations, they will cut things off. They'll calculate everything like these things as functions of lambda. They'll calculate the analogs of those for the pressure as functions of lambda. And then they'll find that it's not generically true that the A, Bs, and Cs you got in the energy density are minus the A, Bs, and Cs you got in the pressure, which is completely reasonable because you're using a regularization which is breaking the symmetry which related the two. So that just underlines that generically contained within the regularization dependence of the answer are choices. And the choices, so you want to know, how do you deal with those choices? So if the regularization scheme breaks Lorentz invariance, then in general what will happen is that P will not be equal to minus rho. So the real question is, how do you deal, what's the significance of things that depend on the regularization scheme? And the answer to that is, in principle, nothing, because you're not done. Once you've regularized something, you're not finished yet, because the whole story in the end of the day was you wanted to have some calculation which gave you something physical, say this, that you were going to measure how it gravitates. You don't care how it depends on the regularization scheme. You care about what the answer is. The physical answer is after you've canceled the divergences and you've got some sort of a finite answer that doesn't depend on that you some finite answer which is not to do with how you defined integrals in your problem. And so you remember this, the program here was that you had these coefficients A, B, and C, and I didn't talk too much about their values because what you're supposed to what you recognize was in the case that we had taken this as our potential. When we plug that into here, then m squared was at most a quadratic polynomial in phi. So what was appearing in here was, for that choice, an arbitrary quartic polynomial in phi. And an arbitrary quartic polynomial in phi was indistinguishable from the classical contribution to the vacuum energy, which was the potential itself. So we're supposed to take this one loop thing. I should have written it as being, you know, delta. This is the one loop part of it. And the full answer was really always the classical answer. And this was the correction to it, delta V. And so that was V of phi plus, I wrote over there, n to the fourth over 64 pi squared. And so the statement was, The reason we didn't dwell too much on the value of A, B, and C was you can't, if we chose, make this choice, so if we choose specifically a quartic potential, which is special because it's renormalizable, the dimensions of all the couplings are always non-negative powers of mass, then it was true that these things were indistinguishable from these things. And so the renormalization program was the statement that the ambiguity that's appearing here is really corresponding to an ambiguity that you already had here. You didn't know the value of V naught, M squared, and lambda. And the deal always in quantum field theory was you have some parameters in your Lagrangian, and you're going to go out and measure a few things, and that'll tell you what the values of these parameters are. And once you've done that, then everything else is a prediction, because the values that you, because all the predictions you make will depend on the values of these parameters, and you have to first do, in this case, three measurements to nail down those three parameters. And that ambiguity in these parameters is degenerate with this ambiguity in the A, Bs, and Cs, and so we don't need to think about them separately. We can, the renormalization program was not just that. It starts off being the statement that these things are diverging. We don't want infinite answers. So what we say is that what sounds very contrived, we say, oh, well, let's just choose these things to be diverging too. We're going to imagine they depend on our regularization scheme in just such a way that these things, this, that, and that will depend on the regularization scheme I choose, whatever I chose, to cancel the regularization dependence that's appearing here. No one can stop us from doing that, but once we've done that, there's always this ambiguity of the finite parts, because it's not unique. Even if once I've told you how to regulate things, what you call the finite part and what you call the infinite part is ambiguous, because I can always put finite parts into the infinite parts and they're still infinite. So there's always a freedom after you've canceled the regularization dependence to redefine what these values were, and that's your renormalization scheme. So when you actually, and the way you fix all that physically is you go off and measure three things. You infer the values of these three parameters from those three things, and those three things might be the vacuum energy, the mass of the particle we're talking about, and maybe what its scattering amplitude is, with its scattering cross-section is with itself at some specific energy. Once we've done that, that nails down both the divergent and the finite parts, and that process, which you wanted to do anyway, find your parameters in terms of physical observables, for free will both cancel the divergences. It will mean implicitly you had divergences in your parameters to cancel the divergences in the rest of the calculation, and it tells you how to deal with the finite parts. So the lesson of that story is that the regularization program is only halfway through the program. The program is really to regularize things and then renormalize things, find out what these things are by comparing to experiment, let's say. And so when you have a question that comes to you to do with ambiguities in the regularization program, their answer is always in the once you finish the story with the renormalization program. You have to, the physical choice you will make about symmetries, for example, will be in how you renormalize the answer. So you guys did renormalization, right? I know you've done loops and so on. I'm kind of just saying words here because we'll do an example, but. Bottom line is both the divergences and finite parts of things like A, B, C are absorbed into the unknown coefficients, renormalized unknown couplings. In this case, V naught, M squared, and lambda. And these are determined by comparison with some observables. All right. So that's something which is all motherhood and apple pie. How could you disagree with that? And so, coming back to this ambiguity of equation of state, the kind of problem that you run into when you regulate things and you break a symmetry like a Lorentz invariance is very much like what people had in the old days in the 50s when they were doing quantum electrodynamics before they discovered things like Pauli-Villars regularization or dimensional regularization. Because cutoffs also break gauge invariance. Cutoffs, you know, the gauge invariance is the statement that derivatives are coming together with couplings to the gauge fields in just the right way to preserve gauge invariance. But when you start cutting off integrals, then you're treating the derivative differently than you are the interactions. And so generically what you'll find is that things that would have been forbidden to you by gauge invariance also get generated once you do quantum corrections with cutoffs in much the same way as you do here. So for the famous thing if you look at textbooks from the 50s for quantum electrodynamics, like Yauch and Rohrlich say, they often will find things like there's a quantum correction to the mass of the photon, which is non-zero. And that doesn't mean that they believed that the photon had a mass. What it meant was that there was if you break a symmetry with your regularization and you believe that the symmetry is a true symmetry, so it's a symmetry of your renormalized Lagrangian, then what has to happen is that you have to undo the damage that you did with your regularization scheme you want to use your renormalization scheme to undo the damage that you did with your regularization scheme. So if you break a symmetry with your regularization scheme, you want to then renormalize in a non-symmetric way to cancel out the failure of the symmetry due to the regularization. And so one question is, what is that possible? So if a regulator breaks the symmetry, let's say it's a desired symmetry, so we want it to be true in the renormalized theory, right? Then must undo the damage when renormalizing. And this is why people beat to death the Ward identities in the old days, because you often would be regulating things in a way which was not gauge invariant. You wanted to renormalize in a way that fixed that, but how did you know that you fixed it? You go to some consequence of the symmetry, like the Ward identity, and you make sure that your renormalized quantities are satisfying that. And then you've ensured that the symmetry, you've canceled all the damage you did with the regulator. Something you don't have to do. The beauty of a regularization that preserves the symmetry is that it's all good. You don't generate things that are breaking the symmetry, so you don't have to fix it anymore. So you can normalize in a way which preserves the symmetry.
Yeah. Go in the direction of saying that anomalies are always unphysical because they're introduced by some physical thing? Or?
Thanks for asking that. That's the next line. Because you've heard of anomalies, and so the one question is this always possible? And the answer is no, and when it's not possible, those are anomalies. But the definition of an anomaly is always explicitly, it's not that you have a regularization that breaks symmetry. That's not sufficient to show you have anomaly. The statement for anomaly always is, you've broken the symmetry with your regularization, but in a way which cannot be removed by a local counterterm. That's part of the definition. That is part of the definition. And that last part, that last qualification is because of this, that if you could remove the failure of the symmetry with a local counterterm, that means you could renormalize it away. And then it wasn't really an anomaly. It was a Well, the answer is no. And the signature of this being not possible is that there was no choice of a renormalization which would absorb the symmetry. And the renormalizations are happening in all the kinds of terms that were in your Lagrangian, but they're all local. And so that's why they always say that so cannot fix a failure of symmetry in this way if it cannot be absorbed. This is probably too many negatives, right? Absorbed. This is like the old joke, right? That this kind of shows how students should never take seriously what a professor says. So the old joke is the linguistics professor who's talking about double negatives and says, oh, and there's some languages where two negatives means a positive, like in English, that if you're not doing that, then you are doing that. And there's other languages where two negatives is a negative, but there's no languages where two positive is a negative. And the student says, yeah, right. And they learn into a local counterterm. So that's why the definition of an anomaly has that as part of its story. So for example, if someone tells you, if the variation of your Lagrangian turns out to be some number times f mu nu dual, which is what happens in many anomalies, then what you have to ask is there something in the Lagrangian I could have varied that would have given me that? And sometimes you can. I must ask, does there exist Lagrangian such that delta Lagrangian is equal to minus constant FF dual? And it's often true that if your theory, since I'm on an aside here, let me just put it in a box here. So if the original Lagrangian, say, was built out of fermions and gauge fields, let's say it was minus 1/4 F mu nu minus psi bar d slash plus m psi, let's say, then there's none of these that you could choose that would give you that. So then the answer is no. But if you have a field where the variation of the field, a scalar field, under the symmetry we're talking about is phi goes to phi plus constant, plus omega, let's say, then the answer is yes. Then the thing we're looking for would be just minus phi over omega f mu nu. Because the gauge field doesn't transform under for an abelian symmetry, and phi would shift, and that would be precisely what you'd need to cancel that. So then the answer would be yes. So whether these things exist will depend on the field content of your theory. And kind of the famous, and this is kind of the famous example that if you have a Goldstone boson, this kind of a symmetry where something is shifting, automatically it's true that the vacuum is not invariant, because the vacuum semi-classically for the scalar field would have been some value for the scalar field. So if the vacuum had been invariant under the symmetry, then it would have meant that all possible values for phi were also describing the vacuum, which is not true semi-classically, because those are just different values for the field. So if you've done this, you've spontaneously broken the symmetry, and that's the famous loophole to canceling anomalies, that you can, if you have Goldstone bosons, their shifting changes the rules and allows you to cancel things. And so it doesn't always allow you to cancel things, but that's kind of the loophole through which the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation works.
Lost you.
Yeah, because I'm off on a tangent now.
So delta L, this is the FF tilde term.
Yeah.
You're saying that could arise quantum mechanically in the QED Lagrangian, or no?
No. So the statement is, supposing I ask whether or not a particular symmetry is preserved, and this would come up if I had some thing here where I have a left-handed fermions and right-handed fermions being different. Then I would have calculated a triangle diagram, and I would have found that there's a contribution. There's a graph like this, which involves.
It's a parallel.
Yeah, it has fermions inside of it. I would have been looking at the current here, and it has the property that if I vary it under the symmetry, it corresponds to a variation of the action by a term like this. Sorry, this is a. So the important thing here was there was a variation there. And so if I then said, so is that an anomaly, or is that just something which I should be fixing with my renormalization program? The question I have to ask is, I have to take, what are the terms in the Lagrangian that I'm allowed to write down for the Lagrangian, not the variation of the Lagrangian, and ask, are any of them such that if I vary them, I would get this? Because then what I just do is I choose the coefficient of that, I renormalize it in such a way that it cancels this.
So are you saying that if was a scalar with an Etchekrin symmetry, is that what it is? Or? Then there would be a term which would absorb that, or?
The statement is that if I don't have a Goldstone boson, right, then for this kind of thing, typically there does not exist a local thing that the variation would cancel that. But once I do have a Goldstone boson, then I can write down the terms, here's a piece in the Lagrangian, not the variation of the Lagrangian, whose variation looks like this. So that means that I can imagine starting to dial the coefficient of this term in the Lagrangian and asking to cancel the anomaly, I could hope. But that rider in anomalies that says you can't absorb it in a local counterterm is precisely because of this issue that if you can break symmetries in lots of ways, and many of them are not important. It's just to do with how you define the regularization scheme. And it's the It's the universality class that can be removed by local counterterms that are really not telling you anything physical about low energies. So going back to where I came in this issue of do the quantum corrections preserve the equation of state, that really is the issue of whether or not the Lorentz symmetry that you think the low energy theory has and the vacuum has is being broken. And so the answer will depend on how you answer that question. If you think that the physics of your problem is not really Lorentz invariant, and there's a piece and these quantum fluctuations know about it, then it can be true that the quantum corrections will break Lorentz invariance, and then that's life. You're not going to have your vacuum is not going to be Lorentz invariant. But you already said that when you said that it was not a Lorentz invariant theory. But if the system is Lorentz invariant, and there's no anomaly in the Lorentz invariance in these systems that we're interested in, then the rules in that case would have been that Lorentz invariance was a symmetry. And so if we choose to break the symmetry with the regularization scheme, we're obliged to undo that damage with the renormalization scheme. Then we will always find, once we're done, that the renormalized quantities satisfy this by construction. And so then the calculation that I did for you is the only one that really matters. But those words were important. And so people periodically get hung up on them. And there's an important story in there. So, you know, it kind of, that whole discussion tells you that you want to have your regularization scheme preserve as many symmetries as you can, because it just makes life easy for you. And so if we had done this in dimensional regularization, then we wouldn't have had to worry about it. We would have just calculated this, and it would have, for free, all our divergences would have had the property that P was minus rho. And then when we renormalized away the divergences, we wouldn't have had to say anything special about symmetries in concluding that the renormalized quantities also satisfy that. So the lesson of that was an aside, but it's just beware of the pitfall of stopping halfway through the calculation and trust and taking too seriously your regulator. So then that leads to the question of, there's a lot of weird things about these regulators, right? And you might ask, which this calculation also kind of shows you how you get past. There's a lot of not uniqueness in the way things are regulated, and you might wonder, to what extent is that important? Dimensional regularization in particular used to always bother me when I was a student, because the story that you're told is that it's an analytic continuation. You know, you go to complex variables for n, and then you analytically continue, and you make some finite answer, and then you go back to the integers. And that, at face value, is just a bullshit argument, right? Because analytic continuation, you can't analytically continue from a discrete set like the integers. You know, normally you have to have some open region on which you've defined things, and then you can analytically continue away from that open region to the rest of the complex plane, if you like. But if you just have something defined on the integers, then I can always add something which vanishes at all the integers, like sine of the right argument, which is perfectly analytic and agrees with whatever you thought it was, and shows you that the theorem that you rely on for analytic continuation is that once you defined it in some open region, the analytic extension to the rest of the complex plane is unique. So it's not like you have to worry about people making up five different analytic continuations. And that uniqueness is what fails if you're defining things on integers. And so there's a huge ambiguity here. And it just really underlines that there's a lot of freedom in how you regulate things. And so do you need to worry about that? And the party line answer to that is the thing. It sounds very complicated, but it's not really a big deal. It's what's called BP, I always get the names wrong, BPHZ, I think it is. I think it's Bogi, Lyubov, forget him, Hepp, and Zimmerman, I think it is. And I'll switch between Z and Z according to where I learned the physics. And so this is what I learned in the US, so that's why I call it BPHZ. Whereas it's a Z boson, because I learned that in Canada. So the logic of this, what these guys do, is they say that in this program, what you're doing is you're renormalizing things. So you regulate any way you like, that's fine. But in the end of the day, you're then going to add to it some counterterm, which is essentially the contribution, the divergent contribution to your parameters. And the observation they make is very much like the observation that we made here, that typically if someone hands you a divergent integral, if you differentiate it enough times with respect to its arguments, it becomes convergent, because it's always some rational function of p squareds and m squareds, which if you differentiate enough times, you pull enough p squareds into the denominator that they converge, in the same way as worked for us here when we did ddm squared three times, that logarithm became something which eventually was converging. And so the basic observation that these guys make is that all the integrals you're looking at in these Feynman graphs have that property. They make the argument in flat space, but you can generalize it into curved space. But for the flat space argument, they're making the argument that if you differentiated enough times with respect to some parameter, then it's finite. And so that means that the divergence is always something which is in the difference between the integral you had and the integral of the thing that was differentiated. Much like here, we got A, B, and C is the thing that was the ambiguous part, that was the difference between the integral of the convergent differentiated integrand and what we started with. And so because you're always adding, one way to think about A, B, and C is you could have just said, I could have, you know, the way I got them was I different, or the way you got them in the assignment was you differentiated the integrand, did the integral over k, and then integrated the result with respect to m squared. But you could have done the integral and the derivative with respect to m squared before you did the integral over k squared, over k. And thinking of it that way, it just shows you that these a, b's, and c's, you can think of taking the original integrand and writing it as being a convergent integrand plus the piece of the integrand that's diverging. And the way you're identifying it all the time is you're differentiating the original integrand some number of times until you've got an integrand which is whose integral converges. Then you're adding and subtracting, essentially, the divergent part. Then the finite piece is the thing that's always integrating well. And then what's left is always the sums and differences of integrands that are diverging. And typically, they're polynomials in the momenta because of this argument that you, the same way this is always polynomials of the fields, it's because we differentiated and we integrated again, and so we knew that we were getting a polynomial in m squared in that case. If we had differentiated with respect to p squared, we would have had the same story, but we'd have polynomials with respect to momenta. So their claim is that whatever you're doing when you regulate, it's always true that the thing you want to calculate the integral of is always some finite thing up to the addition or subtraction of some thing which is basically derivatives of the integrand you started off with. And that your entire ambiguity in your regularization scheme is in those terms, and that's the same ambiguity you had in your normalization program. So the bottom line is that the reason that you don't worry about the fact that these things are not uniquely defined or that there's a lot of freedom there is that that same arbitrariness is in the things that you're normalizing, and all you cared about at the end was what you got when you combine them. And so, yeah.
Is that related to what people do in DRS2, where they define this homology, like derivatives of stuff which doesn't matter? They define these kind of equivalence classes?
It's related, not exactly the same, but it's related, yeah. It's always living off that same fact, but then that's a much more sophisticated thing where you're kind of tracking degrees of freedom using the homology, yeah. Yeah. So that's just another tangent. But the moral message is that the renormalization is important because it's the thing that's it's the more useful way to think about the ambiguities that are inherent in all these stories. It's you didn't know what the parameters were in your Lagrangian anyway, and so you have to figure out what they are, and you're going to do that by comparing to experiment, and the complete freedom you had in screwing things up with your integrals was really better thought of as the freedom you had in choosing your renormalized parameters anyway, and so might as well take seriously the fact that these parameters are expressing the uncertainty you have in what your physics is. All right, so I think I'm in danger of going on a tangent there, so let me not do that. Okay, so let me tie things together. Where I'm headed now is I want to come back to this problem. So I'm heading towards an argument which is supposed to be that we're supposed to have a prejudice as to how big this answer should have been, and that whole argument got polluted by these divergences that were in the answer. And so the way to think about that, the modern way to think about that, is to think in terms of effective field theories, and that is the effective field theories are kind of taking the magic out of this whole cancellation. The way I've described things to you so far sounds very much like the way someone would have described it to you in the 1950s, and it sounds miraculous, right? It sounds like we have a Lagrangian, we calculate some divergence, we calculate things, they diverge on us, so we regulate them just so we can see what they mean, and we get a whole bunch of ambiguity in what the answers are, and then we say, well, oh, maybe the parameters we have also depend on these things like lambda or epsilon or whatever the divergent things are, and maybe they can depend on them in just the right way that will cancel off this infinite thing, and then we'll cancel these two infinite things against each other, and we'll take what's left and we'll compare it to experiment to 11 decimal places, and that'll be the miracle of quantum electrodynamics. It just sounds crazy, right? It sounds like that's not really the way physics should work. And that's why you read all these quotes from the 50s and 60s by people like Feynman and Dirac, where they're basically unhappy with the neural normalization program. And so there's a, in the 70s, a more physical understanding of what's going on came about, which makes it not such a, and when phrased in this way, you see it's not really a big deal. It's not, that's not the miracle that it sounds. The problem in the standard way of thinking about neural normalization is it's a very old school way of thinking about what the classical action is. And then kind of it's a mode of thinking where you're thinking that God hands you the classical action, you quantize it, and then you compare that to experiment. Whereas nature doesn't care about classical versus quantum. Nature is just out there. And so there's a better way to think about the classical action than as a God-given thing that you put up there and you worship. There's a much more touchy-feely way of thinking about classical actions, and that's what this effective Lagrangian story is about. So effective field theories. And it's not just a conceptual thing. The effective field theories are actually just useful, really useful, because they tell you to organize, they tell you how to organize the scales in your problem in the most efficient way possible. And the idea behind effective field theories is that if you have a hierarchy of scales, so for example, you know, size of a nucleus versus size of an atom or something like that, then there are two related facts that are important. One of them is just an fact of nature is it, you don't need to know about the small distance scales much in order to understand the large distance scales. And that's kind of why science progresses. So nature has this property, what's called a decoupling property. And small distances are largely irrelevant to physics of long distances. Largely is a key word there. It's not completely irrelevant, but they're largely irrelevant to physics of longer distances. So that's the first statement. The second statement is the mathematics that we describe nature with, quantum field theory, has that property too. So the mathematics of quantum field theory also does this. And what it means there is that, so let's say we have these two scales, let's call them L1 and L2. So if we calculate some observable, which is a function of L1 and L2, and if L1 is very much small, let's say L1 is very much smaller than L2, then what happens is that it's always a good approximation. It's always a good idea to Taylor expand in powers of L1 over L2. And this will be approximately some function of L2 plus, you know, L1 over L2. And so the mathematics, which is going to be expressing this property of nature, will just be Taylor's theorem. It's going to be the statement that if you have many scales in your problem, one's much smaller than the other one, then it's usually good to Taylor expand in the small ratio. And then for the most part, you're going to be dominated by this piece which doesn't care about the small thing. So this is the dominant part. So I'm making it sound really banal, right? Why would you spend a lecture talking about this? And so the important thing is that the utility of this observation is, if you have to calculate all the observables and then do this, then you're in the boat that everybody was in the 50s, where you have to do the hard work first to find this function, and then you have to calculate these things. And that's hard. So the utility of effective field theories is the earlier you do this Taylor expansion, the better. And so the observation that people made in the 70s and the 60s, depending on who you talk about, was that you can actually make this expansion in the action already. And then once you do it in the action, then you can then apply the answer to all the observables you're interested in, and you can calculate all these things. You know, there's more than one observable we could be talking about. Let's say we have a list of them. And you can do this Taylor series expansion in the action once and for all, and then for all the observables, you can do this calculation where you've already done the expansion, and it's, of course, much easier to do it that way. So you're going to save a lot of time the earlier you do this expansion. And the earliest is to do it in the action at the very beginning. So that's the motivation. That's, you know, you come for the ease of the calculation, but you stay for the wisdom it gives you about renormalization. So it's once you do this, you see that this is the reason why renormalization is happening the way it does. So the idea is that it pays to expand as early as possible. And that turns out to be in the action itself. Before computing observables. And then, so the bonus is that it gives a physical understanding of renormalization. And so it's in the context of that understanding that I want to go back finally to the answer as to whether we should be worried about how big the vacuum energy is. So that's why we're doing this big, long side trip. All right, so let me start off putting aside renormalization, putting aside the vacuum energy, and let's just say, let's go back to this problem we're interested in how can we possibly arrange, if we have a hierarchy of scales, how can we do the calculation in a way where we do the expansion as early as possible, and then we'll get the bonus for free once we set that problem up. So, so what we need is a formalism in which we can talk about various observables, and let's talk about observables as if they're always correlation functions of something, because we can normally think of the observables we are interested in as obtainable from those. So let's use the. You should be warned that there's effective action means many different things, and I'm going to use it in several different senses here, because historically people called a variety of things effective action, and they're not all the same thing. So let's use the effective action formalism, where I don't mean the one that I really mean, if you can parse that sentence. But I'll make. So I'm putting quotes around it because I don't mean effective actions in the modern sense of it. I don't mean effective field theories. This is going back to the 60s. So that's I'm going to set it up in a path integral way because makes it easy to do. Makes this argument the effective field theory argument very easy to see. So let's calculate. Let's say we're interested in computing things like 5x1, 5xn. For some field, then a way to do that, what I want to do is I want to set up the generating functional for these correlation functions. And that's the effective action in the old sense of the word. So the generating functional, what we want is a generating functional. For these. So that's something of the form of it's some functional. So let's say W of J of X, which is a sum over I equals 0 to infinity of J of X1 times expectation value of phi of X1. Let me write the nth term here. So J of X, let me just write it term by term. So W of J it'll be the vacuum piece, so it'll be integral d4x of J of X times expectation value of 5x plus 1/2 integral d4x1 d4x2 5x1 5x2 J of X1 J of X2 and so on. So it's a thing, if I knew this functional, I could differentiate it n times, I could read off all the correlation functions I want. That's kind of what we're looking for.
This is the logarithm of the generating functional.
Yeah, this is the thing I'm going to really give you is something which, let me not call it W, because I'm going to call something else W. We want a function that does this, morally. And there's going to be some definitions. Depending on how you take logarithms, you know, this thing, what you could be getting here is the sum of the connected ones or the one particle irreducible ones, and there'll be some choices. I'll make the choices in a second, so it's probably good that I don't use W here. So let's define, motivated by that, let's define W of J, which is not going to be defined in exactly that way, is why I'm changing the variables. So let's call it e to the W of J is the path integral over the field of interest of, we'll have the e to the I classical action for phi, but we'll add to the action a piece which is the integral where phi couples to J. So we're using J as kind of a probe for phi. And you know that if J had been 0, then what we have, then e to the I w of 0 is just the path integral d phi of e to the I phi. And that's the thing that if you, when you derive path integrals, is the in-out amplitude of the system. If you had a bunch of variables here like background fields, then this would be the in vacuum evolving through your fields and ending up at the out vacuum, and this is the transition amplitude for it. So I'm just not deriving this, I'm just quoting this, and I'm not completely sure if you've seen the path integral derivation of it, but it looks like you have. Good. Good. So so this is not quite what we want. What we'd like to have is something, I'd like to have something which is not a function of W, but J, but it's something which is a function of the fields themselves. So the definition here was such that if I take dW dJ, right, if I just differentiate this equation, I'm going to get I times dW dJ times the exponential. And then here, when I differentiate, I'm going to pull down an I times a phi when I differentiate with respect to J. So if I cancel the I's, then this times, so this will be equal to e to the minus I W of J, because that's the, when I differentiate this, I still have the exponential, which I'm going to put on the other side, times the integral d phi of e to the I action plus I integral of J times phi times 5x. And so that's the expectation value of phi. And this gives me, I'm dividing now by the in-out vacuum. So this would be in, out, out, in. So that's kind of what I would have called the expectation value of phi. It's the expectation value, and then I normalize it. I normalize the state. So let's call that curly phi, because that's kind of the, that's going to be, when we think about semi-classical limit, that's the thing, this is the thing that would classically have been the classical field, but this will include all the quantum corrections to it. So it'll be nice to track this variable, because it'll be the natural, or a natural way of thinking about the classical field. It's a classical field because it's an expectation value, but it'll be the thing whose evolution I can imagine asking about quantum corrections to. All right, so let me need a board here, so let's go up one. All right, so what I want to do is I want to do a Legendre transformation. So that'll be where I'll close today out. So what we want to have is we want to have the analog of the action, the thing whose equation of motion tells us how phi evolves. So let's define gamma phi. So what we'll do is we'll solve here, I'm thinking of phi is a function of, I can think of it as a functional of J. You tell me what J is, you start adjusting J, you're going to change the expectation value of phi, and that's kind of the point of the exercise, because if I differentiate back to J many times, I'm going to get, I can pull down correlation functions of phi, so it's a generating functional in the way we want. I should have said along the way that the The point of writing it as an exponential is taking the logarithm takes the connected piece. So if at this point, instead of saying e to the I w is this, if I just said the w was this integral, then I would be getting the correlation function, but not the connected piece of it. So I would be keeping all the graphs, you know, like that completely factorize. And the point of taking the logarithm for w is that this combination is going to only have the connected part in it. So this is the generating functional of, it generates connected correlators. But what we'd like to do, I'm more interested in phi as a function of j, because that's the expectation value of phi. I want to know how it classically evolves, say for cosmology. And I'd like to know what's the action whose variation tells me what phi does at the quantum level. And so the way I'm going to do that is by taking this Legendre transformation. I'm thinking of phi being a functional of j. You start perturbing around with j, you'll change what the expectation value of phi is. And I'm going to imagine that I can invert this. So let's say we can solve for j as a functional of phi. So the prescription will be, we'll take w as a function of j, which is a function of phi, and we'll subtract the integral of phi of x times j regarded as a function of phi of x. That's its definition. And it has the property, this is the Legendre magic, that if you just take if I differentiate this thing, d gamma d phi of x, I'm going to get, using the chain rule, I'll have an integral d for y of delta w delta j of y times delta j of y delta phi of x. And then this term, if I differentiate that phi, I just get j. But if I differentiate that thing, I'm going to get integral. Since I'm using x for this thing, let's just call this y just to, so you see where it came from. Phi of y delta j of y delta phi of x. So all I've done is I've just done the chain rule everywhere. And the idea is that what do we know about dw dj? Well, we know that that's equal to phi. So this is really phi of y. And so that means that this and that are actually canceling. And so this is equal to minus j of x because of its definition. So j was some probe I turned on. If I make j equal 0, then the vacuum, the real vacuum, the vacuum for phi without this extra j tickling it, will be it'll be the extremal of gamma. So delta gamma and delta phi is equal to minus j. That's like the equation of motion you would have had. If we had done the equation of motion for phi for that action, it would have been that d action d phi plus j is equal to 0. And so this is related, the equation of motion for phi, curly phi, is related to what the classical equation would have been. But it's quantum corrected, because this gamma, you've done the path integral, you're really talking about a matrix element of the fields. So this is like the quantum corrected equation of motion for phi. And in J0, it just becomes a stationary point of gamma. Good. Now, what I want is a path integral representation of gamma, and then that's where we can stop. So let me just raise the board a little bit so you can see. That one. So what we want to do is we want to write e to the I gamma phi. Well, its definition is that's e to the I w of j minus the integral of j times phi. And this I know the path integral representation for, because that's that, right? So this is a path integral d phi of e to the I classical action for phi. And then I had inside the classical action, I had plus I the integral of j times phi. And then I've subtracted this, but this is actually, this curly phi is not the thing that's being integrated. This is the expectation value that you got. So I can put it inside the integral if I want. So I can write this as like that. So that's the path integral representation for this. And it's kind of, it's hard to stop yourself from writing phi is equal to curly phi plus, let me call this capital phi, because I want to use little phi in this this way of writing it. And that'll have the advantage that, I'm only coupling to little phi here. So then the way to write this path integral is so the prescription for writing the path integral for gamma is I just take the action, I shift it around a background field, and I think of the background field as being the argument of what I'm going to be tracking in the answer. I do the integral over phi, where I couple it to a current, but I only couple a current to the deviation of the background of the full field from the background field. And this kind of lends itself very well to the semi-classical way of calculating things, because you remember when we did things semi-classically, we had some action, we had some background classical solution. We expanded around the background classical solution, and when the interactions were quadratic or cubic or higher in the fluctuations, and then the quadratic part was quadratic in the fluctuations, and that's what we would be doing to this. And you can kind of see that that sets the problem up as Gaussian integrals. If you, for some reason, the cubic and higher terms are small, then you can dominate this by the quadratic terms. And so this is kind of a very useful path integral representation for gamma. And the punchline will be, next class, we want to do this with two fields, heavy and light, because where we're heading is we want to know how do we simplify our lives as early as possible in looking for hierarchies of scale. And what we'll do is we'll write this path integral. We'll choose to couple currents only to things that involve the light field, because that's our statement. We're only going to measure things at low energies. And then we'll ask, can we organize this in a way where it's efficient and we can tailor expand the integrand of the path integral in the ratio of scales before we do the integral, and that'll be the labor savings. And then you'll see all the nice things about renormalization happen in that language. Oops. Let's stop.